get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show's Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to continue our analysis of the global economy today, and I'm going solo once again. And today the focus is going to be Latin America's Made in USA recession. So in previous shows, as you know, we've focused on Europe. We've looked at China. And, of course, a number of shows on the U.S. and Japan. And the focus of these previous shows that have been aired over the last year has been that the global economy is about to slow down. That was about a year ago, that show. And, of course, it has begun to slow down. So that prediction has been on the mark. You wouldn't know it, though, if you look at what the reports are for the U.S. economy. We'll get to that shortly. But globally, there's no doubt that the global economy is slowing. And folks are getting nervous about that. If you had a chance to look at the IMF's recent report or reports by the World Bank or reports by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, which is the research arm of the leading Western economies, Europe, Japan, U.S., all of them are throwing up red flags and saying, whoa, we got a problem here. This global economy is slowing, not collapsing, but slowing. And, of course, when you have slowing real economies, what you have is a slowing rate of increase in prices and even deflation. In other words, when prices go negative, big concern in Europe. And prices everywhere, global prices for real goods and services are just hovering barely above zero. In other words, no price increases. Now, that's significant. Why? Because if you have deflation, businesses don't invest. You know, why should they invest and increase their output when their products finally come to market? They'll be getting less price than they would at the time that they start the new investment. So it throws a damper on investment. It also throws a damper on consumption when prices don't rise or when they decline deflation. Why? Because customers say, well, gee, prices are falling. Let's wait. Looks like they may fall some more. So zero price inflation and or price decrease, deflation, is a dangerous situation for a capitalist economy. And we are approaching that globally. Prices slowing everywhere. And even in the U.S., there's not much talk about that. But you look at real goods and services prices, you know, they're well below, they're around 1%, 1 to 1.5%. You know, this is all interesting because you have conservative economists and talk show pundits and others saying, oh, we're going to have inflation, we're going to have inflation. All this Fed money, pumping money into the economy, which has been about $15 trillion since 2008, the Federal Reserve, our central bank, by means of quantitative easing, i.e. printing money and purchasing assets, financial assets from wealthy investors and institutions like hedge funds and so forth and banks at subsidized prices, in other words, just giving money to rich investors who caused the problems. That's what QE is really all about. And we've spent almost $5 trillion in that sense, we, the Fed. And then the Fed's zero interest rates, which allow banks to come to the Fed and borrow money for free, don't pay anything for it, essentially 0.1%, and then turn around and loan it to hedge funds and other shadow banks at 6%, 7%, 10%, and those hedge funds then go and invest it in financial asset markets around the world, creating bubbles in China and currencies and derivatives and so forth. So they get filthy rich too, the banks. So about $15 trillion has been pumped into the global economy this way, has served to recover the financial system, particularly shadow banks. They're all making more than ever before, and it's a big cause of inequality, of course. They're very wealthy, getting very rich, extra rich that way. But, you know, you would never hear that explanation of why we have growing income inequality by mainstream economists. Mainstream economists kind of say, well, it's because of the tax system, or, oh, it's because of minimum wage. Yeah, it contributes, but that's not significant. Inequality is really being driven by financial asset profits that are at record levels. Just look at the stock markets and bond markets and junk bond markets and all the other financial markets there, all at records. And the folks who have capital incomes and invest in that are the folks who are getting filthy, filthy rich in the recovery. They get rich in the run-up to the crisis, and then they get rich in the recovery. And, you know, income inequality is has two elements to it. Folks who make wages, not growing their wages, and then folks who make capital incomes growing their capital incomes. You know, it's a ratio between the two. And you can have more income inequality because wages aren't growing or falling, which they aren't and are falling. Or you can have income inequality because capital incomes are accelerating. So we got both going on. That's why we have this income inequality. We have runaway financial asset incomes, and we have collapsing real wages for most folks. So the two of them are exacerbating the income inequality problem. But, you know, mainstream economists, they only talk about the one element, and they don't even really focus on wages very well as the main cause, because you don't hear them talking much about the fact that, we have very poor job creation, and to the extent we have job creation, we have low-paid contingent job creation, contingent meaning part-time temp contractors. You know, they're wailing about, gee, wages aren't rising, because the people who are being hired aren't getting full wages. And the wages they are getting, you know, are non-union wages. Unions have been pretty much neutralized and marginalized as a source of raising wages for folks because, as we've said before, there's very little unionization in this country anymore. In private sector, only 6.7% of the labor force is unionized. So we got this problem here of no wage growth. Actually, it's declining. Real wages adjusted for inflation declining 1-2% a year ever since that so-called recovery began. And they were declining even before that. And capital incomes are accelerating. So that's why we have income inequality. So, you know, that's my aside on income inequality trends. Let's get back to the topic at hand, and that is the slowing global economy. And our focus today on how Latin America is really beginning to be the negative recipient of that trend. You know, we look at the global economy, and we have what we call North America, and we have Japan, and we have the EU, Europe. And in Europe, we have the Eurozone, the continental 17 economies, and around the periphery of that, we have the rest of the European Union. So that, we would call that the advanced economies, you know, Japan, North America, and Europe, the AEs, advanced economies, and the rest of the world are what we call the EMEs, or emerging economies. And we have different categories within that larger category of EMEs as well. For example, you know, China is a special case. I don't even know if you can call China an EME anymore. And then we have, you know, the BRICS, you know, Russia, India, Brazil in Latin America, South Africa. Those are the BRICS, or the G20, 20 largest economies, which means we have to add to the BRICS economies like Mexico, Turkey, Indonesia, Argentina, Venezuela, and so forth, making up this second tier of emerging economies. And then below that are all the rest, small economies that are sometimes called frontier economies. So there's really gradations in emerging markets that have to be differentiated, just as there are in Europe and the other advanced economies. But let's call them all the EMEs. Let's keep China out of that for a moment and call the rest the EMEs, emerging market economies. Well, within that context, emerging market economies, Latin America is beginning to show signs of the greatest stress. And particularly the big economies in Latin America, which are, of course, Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela. And we could treat Central America as a subset of Latin America economies. We're going to see how they aren't quite in the same boat. That's because Central America has been significantly integrated into the North America U.S. economy, and most notably, of course, Mexico, which has been integrated now for 20 years as a result of the North American Free Trade Agreement in the mid-90s. So Mexico is tied into the U.S., makes it a special case in that we will see the effects are different from U.S. economic policies. And then, of course, in 2005, the U.S. added the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and most of the Central American and Caribbean economies, except Cuba and a few others, are exempt. That's also a degree of integration with the U.S. economy. And then there's special cases like Panama and Colombia, with which the U.S. has been able to negotiate free trade agreements. But the rest of Latin America is more independent. And in the rest of Latin America, we have the three big economies, Argentina, Brazil, and Venezuela. And it's not by accident that those three biggest economies are now experiencing the greatest stress, economic stress. And they are all in recession now. And the recessions will get much worse over the coming months. So the real weak spot in the global emerging market economies are Latin America. Of course, there's some economies in Africa that are in particularly poor shape, too. But we want to focus on Latin America here today. Okay. The global economy slowing. Let's talk about that in a little more detail, right? The problem is manufacturing is slowing everywhere in the world. The only place that manufacturing is growing is, to some extent, in the U.S. Why is it growing in the U.S.? Growing in terms of output, by the way, not in terms of jobs. The jobs are flat. Not much job growth, if anything, the entire year here, as the U.S. manufacturing has risen some. So what's driving that manufacturing growth in the U.S.? Well, primarily two things, I would say. One is production supporting the shale and oil expansion going on primarily in two places in the U.S., in the Dakotas and in Texas. We have this boom in oil shale. Oil, gas, and oil, by the way. We talk about fracking, oil or shale gas fracking. But even bigger, that fracking is really, when we talk about gas, and it's usually justified, oh, let's pump natural gas because that helps the environment. Well, it really doesn't. That's a big myth. But that argument that gas is burns cheaper and it's less CO2 and so forth is really a cover for the fact that fracking is producing a huge increase in oil in the U.S. The U.S. is pretty much now independent of oil. It keeps importing some oil from Saudi Arabia and others, which it will slowly reduce because of the political alliances with those Kuwait, Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, so forth. But it's already reducing dramatically the oil imports from everywhere else, from Nigeria and so forth. Nigeria now no longer imports any oil to the U.S. So it's this boom in oil and shale gas that's boosted the economy in the U.S., and at least in the numbers, and manufacturing supporting it. However, it's very regionalized. It's having an effect on GDP numbers in those two particular areas, in the Plains, the South Plains, the North Plains, Texas and Dakotas, but that impact is not really felt elsewhere in the country. Okay, so, you know, it boosts the numbers, the GDP and manufacturing numbers, but it doesn't really have a general positive effect throughout the rest of the U.S. economy. The second element that's boosting manufacturing in the U.S. is auto sales and auto expansion. And that's being driven, by the way, by deep, deep discounts. The auto companies are really competing with each other, and they're really giving all these kinds of deals and discounts to keep the auto industry going on fumes, pretty much, because that kind of discounting has been going on for 3 years now. And at some point, everyone, or largely most people who have wanted to buy an automobile or a truck, will have done so, and they're closely approaching that point. It doesn't matter what the discounts are going to be. And also, the auto growth is being stimulated what's called auto subprime loans, just like the mortgage subprime loans. In other words, they're selling these cars to people at low discounts and so forth, who can hardly afford to buy them anyway, but the deals are so good that folks are able to do that. So we have a lot of subprime going on in auto. Same problem we have with housing subprimes. Not quite exactly the same, but it's not a basis, really, to expand auto sales. You know, auto sales in general, should be based on rising consumer incomes, household incomes, which isn't happening. To the extent we got consumption going on in this country, we've got it going on based on debt, i.e. loans, and on other artificial factors and forces, you know, not real income growth. Not the best basis for long-run economic growth, from the consumption side at least. Okay, so manufacturing slowing everywhere. It's growing a little bit in the U.S. still, but that's going to reverse as the U.S. dollar continues to rise, and U.S. exports will have will feel the effect. Right. So, longer run, don't count on manufacturing for GDP. Of course, it's not producing any real job growth anymore. The latest numbers were no growth in manufacturing in the last 3 months, and mostly for 2014. It's companies increasing output and making the profits, but the workers aren't sharing in it. All right. Global trade, closely related to manufactured goods, exports and imports of goods, global trade is slowing down as well. Latest figures, I think, for global trade show barely 0.5% growth in global exports here this year so far. I mean, that's like nothing. 0.5%. And if you look at the early part of this year, global trade and exports in the G7, the largest seven economies, which is the AEs, you know, advanced economies, plus the BRICS, you know, the five BRICS, that's most of the world's economy, two-thirds, dropped to 2.6% in the first quarter of this year, and hasn't really recovered much since then. So, you know, that coincides with manufacturing slowing everywhere. The global trade is declining, and international research arms like the IMF and the World Bank and OECD, and all, they're raising their red flags. Whoa, wait a minute, we got a problem. Global trade is slowing down. Now, when it slows down, what you have is countries trying to boost their exports and therefore their economy at the expense of other countries. And they do that by trying to engineer a decline in their currencies. And that's happening. It's a kind of competition, global capitalist competition, by manipulating interest rates, by manipulating their money supply. Lower interest rates, lower business costs, and in so doing, give your countries, companies that export at a little bit of advantage for a period of time. The problem with this, though, is that everybody can do that. So we have the seesaw going on, monetary policy and currency wars. Those things tend to be temporary, as everyone can play that game, which is what they did during the Great Depression of the 30s. They played that game. Of course, then you had currencies pegged to gold standard, so it was fiat declaration, political declaration of lowering of currency exchange rates. But now the lowering is done by monetary policy and manipulating currencies to get an advantage. There also, it's interesting that in Europe particularly and in Japan, policymakers are talking about what they call labor market reform. And that is, well, let's get an advantage, not just by manipulating our currency exchange rate, but let's reduce our wages. You know, whenever you hear labor market reform, it's a code word that says, let's attack workers' wages and lower their wages, and that way lower corporate costs and get a competitive advantage in exporting our goods. Well, you know, look at Spain. That's exactly what's going on in Spain, but to some extent Portugal. You know, the depression has been so bad and so long there, and there's such huge jobless, 50% youth unemployment in those countries, that businesses there have been able to impose big wage cuts. And that's given them a cost advantage with competitors, and therefore they've been able to boost their exports a little bit. It's a race to the bottom, you know. If everyone wants to do that, reduce wages as a way of getting a cost advantage to boost exports in their economy, then it's a race to the bottom at the expense directly of the working classes, right? So these are all signs of instability and weakness out there in the global economy, when manipulation of currencies is a way to get an export and economic growth gain at the expense of your neighbors, and then lowering wages is another way of doing the same thing. This is all part of the growing competition between capitalist countries and companies in those countries. It's growth at the expense of beggaring your neighbor, rather than growth at the healthy expense of rising incomes and rising real investment. Right? That's a characteristic of 21st century global capitalism. You know, it's not healthy growth. It's unhealthy growth. And when they start attacking each other and stealing growth from each other, that's a sign that there's a problem in the system. Now, that's directly related to what's happening in Latin America. How so? Well, what we've got today is what I would call the grand contradiction going on. What is that? What's the grand contradiction? It's this. U.S. policymakers, U.S. capitalists, and their institutions like the Federal Reserve, right, have decided here over the past year, and they're moving towards distant stages, have decided that it's no longer necessary or a good idea to keep pumping trillions of dollars into the U.S. and global economy. They're worried that pumping these trillions, and the Fed has pumped at least $15 trillion into the U.S. banks and finance, shadow banks and non-shadow banks, and into global banks. You know, the U.S. Fed has bailed out European banks roughly to the tune of $1 trillion as part of that $15 trillion minimum. Okay, so pumping all that money into the global economy, as I said before, has not resulted into real investment growth. It was growth that investment and expansion, business expansion, and making things that would require hiring real people and paying them wages, you know. A lot of that $15 trillion has gone into financial speculation around the world, and financial markets of various kinds, right? Emerging market funds and foreign real estate, like in China, local real estate in China, a lot of money has gone over there, in currency speculation, in derivatives around the world. That's where all this money has gone. It's also gone into investing in real assets around the world. Between 2010 and 2013, not all this money has flowed out and gone into financial markets. Some of it has gone into real investment, expanding infrastructure and output and production elsewhere in the world, including Latin America. So picture the outflow of all this $15 trillion. And, of course, the same thing happened in the U.K. and elsewhere. Picture it, most of it flowing out to emerging markets of various kinds, including, significantly, China between 2010 and 2013. A lot of this money flowed out to China. Well, why did it flow out, to emerging markets in China? Why wasn't it invested here? Because the profits were bigger there. And, the money goes, first and foremost, where the best profits are. So it's flowed out to emerging markets, China and others, between 2010-13, and the economies of those countries has boomed as a result. All this money flowing out, for investment purpose in finance, financial assets and non-financial assets. At the same time, China in 2010 really stimulated its economy fiscally. It spent about 15% of its GDP on its fiscal recovery, its stimulus, after the 2008-9 crash. And its economy boomed as a result. And as the Chinese economy booms, Chinese economy very manufacturing and construction-oriented, the demand for resources and commodities from around the world rose as well. China needed copper, China needed iron, China needed all these resources. China doesn't have a lot of these resources, so where did it get it from? Oh, it gets it from places like Latin America, Australia, and other resource-rich Africa, resource-rich areas of the global economy. So when China's economy booms because of its own massive fiscal stimulus and the flow of capital, money capital from the U.S. and Europe into China, huge amount of money available for investment. A lot of that goes into real expansion of their manufacturing base, which results in turn in the big demand by China for commodities and resources and semi-finished goods from around the world, including Latin America. So Latin America's economy booms for two reasons, right? One, China's huge stimulus and demand for Latin America's resources, Brazilian food and soybeans and all the other resources there, Peruvian and Chilean copper and so forth, and Argentina and so forth. So Argentina and Latin America are pulled up by the China boom from 2010 to 13. At the same time that this demand for Latin America resources occurs, money flows from the U.S. and Europe into Latin America as well. Not just into China, but into Latin America. Huge inflows of this capital, this $15 trillion U.S. and several trillion euro, Bank of England and European, Japanese central banks, right, flows into Latin America to help finance the expansion of their own production to meet the demands of China. And when their own production in Latin America rises, well, the stock market values of those companies that are expanding in Latin America also rises. So more money flows into Latin America, into the stock and bond markets from the north. Huge money flows. A combination of the China expansion and the real economy in Spanish in Latin America, and the money to finance that coming from the advanced economies produces this significant boom in Latin America until 2013. What happens in 2013? Well, a lot of the money that flowed into China from the advanced economies stimulated the shadow banks and financial market speculation in China. It led to a Chinese housing boom, right? A bubble in housing, and a bubble in local government infrastructure investment. And China began to lose control of its money flows, because all of this money was flowing in through the shadow banks, hedge funds and equity firms and so forth, in deals being cut with local governments to expand housing and other construction, local construction. And we get these bubbles in local government debt in China and in housing debt in China. So China wants to, in 2013, bring that under control, bring it to a halt if it can, because it doesn't want financial bubbles and bust down the road. So what China does is try to slow the economy to tame the shadow banks that are beginning to destabilize their economy. By the way, the shadow banks are speculating not only in local government infrastructure and housing, but they're speculating in Chinese currency as well, the yuan, which just kept steadily rising, rising, rising. Well, if you know an asset's going to keep rising, that's what you want to invest in, because as it rises, you reap capital gains. So they were driving up, the shadow banks, driving up Chinese financial currencies as well. Well, once again, to return, China wanted to bring all this speculation going on by the Western money inflows to a halt, or at least to slow it down. So what China did in 2013 was to slow its economy by shifting to more contractionary, we might say, fiscal and monetary policy, slowing down its spending and slowing down its own attempt to increase its own money supply internally. That slowed the Chinese economy down. It didn't have much initial impact on the shadow banks and the Western speculation inflows, but it did slow down the economy. Well, when the Chinese economy slows down, its demand for commodities and natural resources and semi-finished goods from Latin America as well as elsewhere also slows down. Okay, so that was an early sign in early 2013 that this big stimulus to Latin American economy, the China demand for its goods and commodities, was slowing, and that had an initial negative impact on Latin America and economies. At the same time, coincidentally, in the spring of 2013, the U.S. Federal Reserve announced that it was going to start reducing its QE, i.e. the free money that it was pumping into the U.S. and global economy, a lot of which was flowing south to Latin America. So a double whammy occurred. China started slowing down, said it would, and the U.S. money flow said that spigot would soon be turned off, and that panicked Latin America financial markets and produced what was called the taper tantrum. Taper means tapering down, reducing U.S. QE, and thus money flows. What happened was a real negative reaction in the summer of 2013 in Latin American economies. That negative reaction was their currency started declining dramatically. Their stock and bond markets started declining or slowing, and money started flowing out of Latin America, capital flight out of Latin America, which slowed their economies even more. So what did Latin American economies do to try to stem the outflow of capital? Well, they started raising their own interest rates to attract that capital back. But that slowed their own domestic economies. This gets complicated, doesn't it? I mean, but this is economics. You can't get around these fundamental multiple connections. Because if you don't understand the multiple connections, you don't understand the outcomes. So in 2013, the summer, really a decline in currencies in Latin America, capital flight, flowing out, slowing their economies, reducing their stock markets, having additional effect that when you reduce your currencies, when the currencies decline, then the cost of imports rise. Inflation at imports rise, then these economies are heavily dependent on exports and imports. So their exports slow and their imports rise in terms of total cost. So it causes inflation in those economies. That has a secondary knock-on effect, because if you're causing inflation, that's going to reduce foreign capital inflows into those economies as well. So we have capital outflows. We have less foreign direct investment into those economies as money flows out of those economies, as their currencies fall, as their imports inflation rises. Oh, it becomes a multiple kind of negative scenario, doesn't it? Well, that occurred last summer, 2013. It looked like it was going to be a very serious situation, so the Federal Reserve backed off of its announcement last summer, of initial announcement of eliminating tapering QE, all the free money, temporarily. Because when it looked like it stabilized a little bit by the end of August last year, 2013, the Fed then announced again, oh, the taper was on again, right? We started having the same effects, negative effects in Latin America. But then the Fed backed off again and said, well, wait a minute, not yet. That was because we had all this government shutdown nonsense going on in the U.S., right? Remember shutting down our federal government? The Fed did not want to start tapering while this big fiscal issue was still unresolved. But once that got resolved in October, November of last year, then the Fed said, oh, we're going to start now. And that's what it did. It started doing the tapering late last year. Instead of $85 billion every month of free money pumped into the U.S. and thus leaking out into the global economy, financing all this expansion in the world and speculation, Fed started reducing, first to $75 billion, then $65 billion, so on and so forth. So the Fed is now ending its QE. It wanted to give the emerging markets time to adjust to the slowing of all the free money flowing in. Well, they're adjusting, but their economies are slowing, and we have growing problems of currency decline and capital outflow and slower foreign capital inflow and declining stock markets and rising inflation in these economies, especially the big three in Latin America. Oh, so let's look at what the growth is in Latin America, particularly in the big three. The total growth estimates are being significantly reduced by the IMF and the OECD and the World Bank and all the others. They're all reducing their estimates of growth. And if you look at the real growth in these economies, Argentina is already in recession. Okay, the last indications, last quarter indications, and for the year is for a decline in Argentina GDP of somewhere between 1-2%, which is significant, by the way. It doesn't sound, but it is significant. Right? How about Venezuela? That's declining even more, somewhere between 3-5% GDP decline. So they're in a recession. No doubt, right? What about Brazil? Well, Brazil's in a recession too. The big economy down there, Brazil, right, is now first two quarters negative. You know, 0.3%, 0.5%, 1%, whatever. But Brazil is negative. The three big economies in Latin America have all turned negative. Now, overlaid on top of that, it appears that American policymakers are really trying to target and punish these big economies down there, particularly Argentina and Venezuela, but also Brazil. All right. Why? Why overlaid on these general economic forces that are slowing the economy there do we have this emphasis, or this appears to be a target against Argentina and Venezuela in particular? Well, let's take the case of Argentina. At the center of this problem, the problems in Argentina, is this fight over Argentine debt, sovereign government debt payments that go back to a previous crisis in Latin America in the early 2000s, and the borrowing that Argentina had to do in order to get out of the crisis, and the repayments of that. Argentina renegotiated its debt with these foreign capitalists, banks and foreign capitalists who had loaned it a lot of money to expand in a previous phase in the 90s, had renegotiated an agreement to pay significant part of what was owed, but not all of it. This happens all the time. Companies approach bankruptcy, and what they do is negotiate with their creditors and agree to pay them part of it. I mean, this is what all bankruptcy negotiations are all about. And you know, the creditors say, well, it's better to get two-thirds of it rather than none of it. If you go bankrupt, we'd rather use to continue and pay us something, and we'll go forward, right, because we're making good profits anyway, even on a renegotiated deal. Well, that occurred, before 2008, that kind of started, and the deal was cut between Argentina and its creditors, many of whom were shadow banks, investment banks, hedge funds, and so forth, and Anglo-American. Well, there was a couple of them, hedge funds, that said, nope, we're not going to agree to anything. The big hedge funds by Paul Singer, big billionaire speculator in the U.S., and a couple of others said, no, we're not going to agree to any deal. We're going to fight you in court. Most of the creditors agreed to the deal. And they said, no, we're not going to agree. Okay, so this thing has finally come to a court decision here 10 years later. And this is what the big fight now with Argentina is about, by the financial shadow banks, which in Latin America they call vulture funds. And it's true, they are vulture funds. And what you got was a court decision. The U.S. court stepped in here recently and said, Argentina, we don't care if you agreed with 95% of your creditors and everyone else was happy. You got to pay the non-credit, those who did not agree, the full amount that you owe them, right? And the court said, you can't even pay off those who you agreed with. We're not going to let you pay off those who want to get paid off that you agreed with until you pay the full value to Paul Singer and his vulture funds. Well, that's kind of courts interfering, right? U.S. courts, by the way, federal courts, saying on the sides of the vulture funds, saying, okay, too bad, Argentina, pay up, Which means Argentina and other sovereign countries will never be able to negotiate a deal again because they know there will always be handouts, or holdouts, rather, holdouts like the Singer's Vulture Fund, and that they will always mess up the deals if they get away with this. It's interesting to note that while the U.S. has taken this position against Argentina and sovereign debt of that country, the U.S. has taken and courts have taken a totally opposite position when it comes to U.S. debt. What do we mean? Well, recently, court decision said that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, U.S. agencies that hold mortgage debt, did not have to pay the demands of those who sued them for extra payment. A very similar deal where, you know, the financial companies, the holdouts, wanted Fannie Mae to pay them even more, didn't get the U.S. court to agree to that. So the U.S. court and government protects itself from these financial speculators, in this case, in the mortgage side, but says just the opposite for foreign sovereign debt. It's kind of like a double standard. Well, this fight's been going on in Argentina between the vulture funds and so forth, and it's exacerbating their problems. Even more capital outflow is occurring, and the currency is declining even sharper, and inflation from imports rises even more and slows their economy even more. It's a fight. The American capitalists are fighting with their courts and government. They're fighting Argentina to teach a lesson to all of Latin America and all emerging markets that borrow money and renegotiate debt. Okay. The situation's even worse in Venezuela because very clearly the U.S. is trying, and corporations are trying, to destabilize that economy significantly. You know, not too long ago, a year or so ago, there was an attempted coup there that didn't occur. So, you know, they backed off on Argentina on an overt political overthrow, and their whole approach now is to help wreck the economy even more in Argentina. I'm not Argentina, Venezuela, to create even more discontent, and they'll try another political move very shortly here, probably in another year, to destabilize and overthrow the Venezuelan government. So they got to wreck the economy even more. And, of course, Venezuela's economy is very dependent on oil, and because of the global slowdown, the demand for oil is slowing, and that's a big currency source for Venezuela. And the global slowdown and slowdown in oil, oil's now below $100 a barrel and falling, is also having a severe impact on the Argentine economy, which is now, as I said, in 2014, contracting 3 to 5% compared with just 2 years ago when it was growing at more than 5%. So problems there. The point is that these problems in Latin America are the direct result of U.S. monetary policy. As I said, the central bank has decided that pumping more money into the economy is causing bubbles, and we don't need to pump any more into the banks because they are fully recovered in the U.S. and then some, right? The U.S. has decided that further monetary growth should come by recalling back all this money capital that flowed out into the emerging markets. Try to kill two birds with one stone, right? Reduce the possibility of creating financial bubbles and further bubbles in the stock and bond markets in the U.S. By reducing monetary injections via QE. And let's also talk about raising interest rates that would hopefully further reduce the possibility of financial bubbles. And those rising rates will result in the money capital flowing back to the U.S. from the emerging markets, including Latin America. That's the new shift in monetary policy. And even the talk of raising interest rates is already having that effect. The dollar is rising, so investors want to take their money out of currencies like the Argentine peso and others that are falling, because that means losses. Take your money out of there and buy dollars. As the dollar rises, you know, you're going to make a capital gain. So money's flowing out of Latin America. It's even flowing out of Europe as the euro begins to fall further. Those who had invested in euro currencies are selling those, causing it to fall further, and they're buying dollars, which is rising. The U.S. dollar is rising strongly. So the talk of rising interest rates and the talk of the U.S. dollar growing, rising, is causing money to flow back from around the world into the U.S. economy. Well, if all this money capital is flowing back to you, the Federal Reserve does not have to pump money in, right? But all this money flowing back means these other economies are going to slow. There won't be as much money capital for investment in those economies. And their stock markets are going to slow as they sell off their stocks in order to get cash to buy into U.S. stocks and U.S. dollars. Right? So this monetary shift by the U.S. and the Federal Reserve is having great negative impacts around the world on emerging markets in general, and particularly in Latin America, because the U.S. is attacking the key economies in Latin America. The U.S., by the way, is watching closely what happens in the outcome in Brazil, because if Da Silva and you know, even more progressive people get elected there, they will have to take some action as well. But, you know, they are targeting today the economies of Latin America, particularly Argentina and Venezuela, in anticipation of political moves down the road there. I mean, they're really preoccupied elsewhere in the Middle East, they, meaning American capitalists, and in the Ukraine, manipulating that situation politically there. And as I said, for the purposes of severing the growing relationships between Western Europe, particularly Germany and Russia, economically, the U.S. is very concerned that Russia and Germany are getting too integrated economically. So they want to stop this, and I believe that's the fundamental strategic geopolitical objective of the U.S. by provoking this problem in the Ukraine. You know, if you provoke a crisis in the Ukraine, which they did with their U.S.-run coup last February, get the Russians to overreact, and therefore use that way of getting Western Europe to impose severe economic sanctions on Russia, and that would break that growing economic integration between Russia and Germany and Western Europe. That's the goal. You know, keep Western Europe closely tied to U.S. Purse strings here and its economy, and keep them, you know, in our orbit. Don't let them drift into the orbit of Russia. But Putin's been pretty clever so far in trying to dampen that objective by the U.S. Okay, been clever how he goes about dealing with this economy thing, and I mean this integration thing with Western Europe and the U.S. Okay, so that's Ukraine in a nutshell, I believe. But we have a similar thing going on with emerging markets elsewhere as well. But while the U.S. is preoccupied with Ukraine and Middle East and preparing to oppose China even more, lining up its support, you know, to isolate China even more, it's preparing the ground for, I believe, a future re-engagement politically in Latin America. But first, you got to soften up those economies and make you know, the leadership in those countries more vulnerable. And that's what's going on, particularly with Argentina and in Venezuela right now, and possibly Brazil. At the beginning of the show, I said Central America and Mexico are a little bit different. Yes, they are, because Mexico is far more integrated than the U.S. The U.S. policy with Mexico strategy right now is to buy up their government Pemex oil company and use it to produce more shale oil and shale gas down there in Mexico. And Mexico, being tied to the U.S. economy anyway, sees the opportunity of getting U.S. investors to come in and modernize its oil sector and turn it into a shale oil production so that it can compete and further integrate with the U.S. So they're selling off their big national resource, privatizing it, and U.S. banks will and U.S. oil companies will get a bigger chunk of that. So, you know, the Mexican economy is increasingly tied to the U.S. and therefore not as negatively impacted by this money flow back because of the purchase and the integration of Mexican oil. We still have U.S. capital inflows into Mexico, unlike in the rest of Latin America, where the you know, the future is outflows of money back to the U.S. Okay, so the picture is an interesting picture. We are in a transition period, a shift going on in the global economy, and to sum up that shift. Means the U.S. policies is to bring back all that money capital that flowed out and got those big profits in between 2010 and 13. They've exploited that. They've gotten you know, super rich on that exploitation. Now it's time to bring that money back, and policies are of raising interest rates and letting the dollar rise, both of which are connected, will cause money to flow out of Latin America. All that money flowed in to finance the expansion when there was all this Chinese demand for Latin American commodities and resources, right? All that money's flowing out now. And the result is you're going to have a decline in their stock markets, which has already happening, a decline in their currency, which means import inflation is going to rise and slow their economy down even further, and to stop the capital flight outflow, these economies are raising their interest rates, and of course that slows their economy even more in the long run. Raising interest rates is a short run solution to try to attract capital, but in the long run it slows your economy even more so. So they have kind of a Hobson's choice down there in those economies, you know, whether to raise rates and bring the money back, help to stem the capital outflow and slow your economy longer term, or to take some other action that would not slow your economy long term. But it's all designed to weaken those economies down there, as the U.S. will eventually reorient back to reassert its control over Latin America. You do it first by destabilizing the economies, and then you do it politically. And that's the two big targets are Argentina. Make a lesson out of Argentina that you've got to pay your vulture funds or else, right? You guys can't renegotiate deals. And then Venezuela, of course, you know, it's kind of like anathema ever since Chavez was running the show there. You know, it's a thorn in the U.S. Capitalist side there. They just don't like that idea of nationalizing companies and resources and so forth. It's a bad example to the rest of Latin America and the world if they get away with that. So they're, you know, they haven't given up. They never give up destabilizing. They will keep coming back at you again and again and again. Latin America then is you know, at a center point of weakness as far as the global economy is concerned, and it's going to be interesting to see what occurs further in terms of these economic problems in Latin America, and particularly in the three countries that are the big players in South America and that the U.S. is really targeting with extra policies to destabilize those governments now that they are weaker as the capital flows out from those countries. Okay, I think that about does it today for our show. And once again, it's all part of our ongoing analysis of the slowing global economy and the capitalist recovery that isn't much of a recovery. The wealthy and the finance and the big corporations have recovered at the expense of the rest. And the U.S. is now trying to keep its very weak recovery going, but doing so at the expense of other economies around the world by sucking back all the money capital and keep it going here in the U.S. at the expense. So U.S. growth, to the extent it exists, and it's very tentative, to the extent that it exists, is coming increasingly at the expense of the rest of the world. And this is all part of capitalism today globally, countries trying to keep their economic head above water at the expense of their neighbors, of their capitalist neighbors, which is a sign of a very weak position and condition in the global economy and of capitalism itself, global capitalism. They're all beggaring each other's neighbor. Now the U.S. is really about to beggar all its neighbors. Okay. Next week, we will follow up and with a series of shows on politics and the elections coming up in the U.S. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.